linguistic objects.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. And no, there is nothing wrong with your MP3 player. What is a little different today is that I've finally purchased a good microphone. As you old-timers know, for the first couple of dozen podcasts, I was using a $12 headset mic. Then, once I figured out that I'd be doing these podcasts for a while, I upgraded to a $24 headset microphone. And that got me through podcast number 139. But here we are at number 140, and for the first time, you're probably hearing what I really sound like. I can remember the first time KMO and I talked on the phone, and the first thing he said was that he was wondering what my voice actually sounded like because it was different on most of the podcasts. Now, I still haven't quite figured out the best way to use this new mic, which is a Rode Podcaster, by the way, and I suspect that it will take us all a little while to get used to the new sound. But one nice feature of this mic is that it has a jack for me to directly connect a headset to and hear what I sound like as I'm recording. And that means that hopefully you won't get as many voice spikes from me when I get excited. So stay subscribed, and we'll see how this works out in the weeks and months ahead. And I'm sure I'll get some microphone-using advice from some of you, which I will appreciate and take to heart, I'm sure. Now, the first thing I'd like to do using this new mic is to thank two of our fellow saloners who sent in a donation this week. And they are Samantha P., and longtime supporter, frequent donor, and active participant on our Psychedelic Salon online forums, and is perhaps aptly named A Dime Short. So A Dime Short and Samantha, I thank you for your donations, and I'll see that they're used in support of these podcasts. I really appreciate your help. And please don't feel like you need to make a donation to this salon. Just telling your friends about these podcasts is more than enough for you to do. Without any real planning or by design, our weekly get-togethers here in the Cyberdelic Space have grown into a sizable crowd. And so I was very pleased, but not completely surprised, that after I mentioned a few weeks ago that Dr. Grobe's psilocybin study had run out of funds, well, some of our fellow saloners stepped up and made very large donations to keep it running. As a result, this past Saturday, Dr. Grobe and his partners, Dr. Preet Chopra and Alicia Danforth, successfully completed the last session with the final participant in the study. Before he left the hospital that day, Dr. Grobe, who everybody knows as Charlie, called and left the following message for us here in the Psychedelic Salon.
Yeah, hello. This is Charlie Grobe calling. I'm happy to announce that as of today, May 10th, we've treated our 12th and final patient for our psilocybin treatment of cancer anxiety. We would like to certainly thank the our generous donors, including those who've given funds to the Hefter Research Institute, also the Betsy Gordon Foundation, and also the very generous donors who responded to the Psychedelic Salon podcast recently. And again, we're delighted to be able to announce that we've successfully completed the study. The next step will be to do a thorough analysis of our data, and then to write and submit report and a new protocol back to the regulatory agencies requesting permission to extend the cancer anxiety study with similar number of subjects but at a higher dose. So again, we're very appreciative of the support we've had from the community, and we'll be looking forward to speaking further on the analysis of our data. Thank you very much. Bye-bye now.
And you can rest assured that as soon as Charlie's report is final, he'll stop by the salon and give us an early look at the results, as well as letting us hear a little bit about his protocol for the next phase of this important study. Now let's get to the first of two talks I'm going to play for you today. The second one is a 20-minute introduction to a McKenna, Sheldrake, and Abraham trialogue in which Ralph Abraham tells the story of the deep involvement psychedelics had on the math and computer revolutions of the 60s. But first, I'm going to play another talk from the recent World Psychedelic Forum held in Basel, Switzerland. Thanks to our friend and fellow saloner, Otto Weidel, and what he calls his brave little MP3 recorder, most of the English talks from that conference were posted via a thread on the Psychedelic Salon forum over at thegrowreport.com. And originally, the only talk from that conference that I planned on podcasting was Mountain Girls Talk, which you heard in program number 135. The rest of the English language talks from that conference are being podcast by my friend Max Freakout each Friday on his excellent podcast, Psychonautica. In fact, Max's program last Friday featured one of Dennis McKenna's talks from that conference, and it'll really blow you away, I think, particularly when he mentions the fact that there are quite literally thousands of DMT-containing plants. And then he goes on to talk about psychoactive frogs, snakes, and even fish and insects. If you're still in school and thinking about getting into psychedelic research, well, I think Dennis's talk will give you leads on a lot of different directions you could take for particularly graduate dissertations. Can you tell that I enjoyed that podcast? Well, you can find it at dopefiend.co.uk, and along with many other good podcasts there. I think this one with Dennis is Psychonautica number 35. Now, getting back to the talk I'm about to play, during the past year or so, I've received quite a few emails telling me how much they got out of podcasts 7 and 8, which were titled Art, Love, Family, and Psychedelics. And that was from a Palenque Norte lecture at the 2003 Burning Man Festival. The topic was presented by Alex and Allison Gray and their daughter Zena. So when I saw that Allison and Alex had given another family and psychedelics presentation at the Basel conference, I asked Max Freakout if he minded if I podcast that talk here in the salon too, and of course Max had no problem with that, so here we are. The official program for that conference gave the title of their presentation as Psychedelic Families, What Do We Tell the Children? And if you are of a psychedelic mindset and are a parent or grandparent, well, this is a very difficult question. What do we tell our children? In this day and age, that can be a difficult question to answer. So let's listen to what Allison and Alex Gray have to say on this sensitive topic. The recording actually begins with Alex in mid-sentence, but I don't think too much of the beginning of this talk was missed. Now, here are Allison and Alex Gray speaking one Sunday morning in 2008 in Basel, Switzerland.
And where drugs weren't discussed at all, you know.
We had no discussion with our parents about drugs. And yet, surrounding us on all sides were a variety of different kinds of things. My mother smoked.
My mother smoked through three pregnancies, so did yours.
Yeah, and alcoholism sort of hovered in the background of both of our families.
Although our parents weren't alcoholics. But yeah. they took a drink, you know, like, you know, socially. Only the legal drugs they used.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
So they were completely unprepared for the 60s and for our behavior. This is another way of thinking about families. You know, we got two Aussies here. Aussie and Harriet was the kind of family that I grew up with, thinking this is the norm, and this was kind of the American ideal of the happy family, you know, with its teenagers. And the Ozzy Osbourne and the Osbournes present maybe an update and of someone who's been through the drug situation and is working it out with their kids and stuff like that. I think that what characterizes both of the families, obviously, is that they care about each other a lot. And even if the Osbornes are pretty eccentric by many standards, you can tell that there is love there.
And they stay
as well
together, which
yeah,
in this day and age is really quite something. And they are a psychedelic family. So,
yeah,
you know, here, here.
Yeah. So what's the problem with drug education usually? And we'll cover some of the ideas about drug education first off. Is that there is this kind of overriding mischaracterization of the drugs and an exaggeration of the problems that marijuana especially gives us.
And, yeah, and then they contradict people's own observations, like, you know, if marijuana is not really going to kill you, then maybe, you know, cocaine won't either, or heroin won't either. Like, I don't believe it. You know, people told me that about marijuana. It wasn't true. So why don't I just try something else? I don't believe what people tell me.
Yeah, that's a flaw from the beginning. And this is was one of those campaigns, the ad campaigns, that were very compelling to us, you know, but because it mushes all sort of drugs together, it doesn't really distinguish things. Certainly, it doesn't really give you any kind of distinction about the nature of entheogens as regards the nature of other substances, which are truly harmful.
And it doesn't distinguish between use and abuse.
Yeah. So this is the kind of drug education that we've been living with in America, and the Reagan era's Just Say No campaign, and certainly it was admirable in terms of wanting to safeguard the lives and minds of the young, and it's obviously been parodied through our culture as well, and for very good reason, because it actually doesn't work. What's interesting, although the DARE also program has admirable ideals about wanting to you know, safeguard the young, part of it becomes these unmanageable kinds of promises that the unwitting young are kind of demanded to make. And they're enrolled in this idea that drugs are bad, okay? And so then I pledge to lead a drug-free life. This is like one of the vows that they're asked to make. Before really having an understanding about the true nature of the various kinds of substances. And
and it's a lie. It's a lie, because nobody's going to lead, I mean, maybe Christian Scientists, but very few people will lead a truly drug-free life. They'll take over-the-counter medications, and they'll take you know, prescription medications. They'll use cigarettes and alcohol and still make this pledge. So that's just a lie.
Yeah, it has to do with these kind of inner conflicts and contradictions that end up as hypocrisy, and the kids are fine-tuned to catch any kind of hypocrisy, and that's why. In the follow-up studies, they found that it was actually worked against them. You know, that this pledge became a gateway to abuse for many kids from the suburbs. And so, there's various myths about this kind of that are part of the conventional drug education programs. They rely on the Just Say No. The myth that the experimentation with drugs is uncommon, that drug use is the same as drug abuse. Marijuana is a gateway drug to heroin and cocaine, and then the continued exaggeration of the risks. Looking at the realities, over 50% of high school seniors have experimented with the various kinds of drugs at some point in their lives. Over 41% used a drug during the past year, and around 25% used in the last month. So this is also interesting because of the over-exaggerations. Every 100 people who've tried marijuana, only one is a current user of cocaine. So what we're looking for in terms of education is a kind of harm reduction approach, and it distinguishes between use and abuse, and a majority of drug use doesn't lead to addiction or abuse, and most users of psychoactive substances control their intake. There's a certain kind of ethics for using drugs, not to dose other people, not to use them during school, maybe at work, or in sports, or driving. These kinds of things seem obvious, but these should be.
Well, these are the things that parents fear. I mean, that's why I put that picture in there, that mm-hmm. car. I just couldn't believe it. I mean, this is what we fear, really. There are perils, and we do, we have children, we want to protect them. So drugs can lead to terrible things as well.
Yeah. And it's just unrealistic to think that teenagers are going to avoid drugs when they're trying to push the envelope of their identity, they're trying to discover who they are sexually and consciousness-wise. And so keeping kids safe should be the highest priority, and a reality-based approach would provide honest and scientifically informed education on all the drugs, including the prescription medicines, like the antidepressants, whose kind of side effects can be suicide and mass murder. And then alcohol and tobacco and these other kinds of addictive substances that are a normal part of a routine, instead of demonizing the, entheogens and other kinds of substances. Encouraging moderation if experimentation persists, and promoting an understanding of the legal and social kinds of consequences of drug use, and just putting the responsibility back on the person who's using, and so that they really understand where they're coming from, and aren't just being led along in a kind of a peer slipstream and things like that. The safety first. Yeah, do you want to?
No, please. Continue.
Yeah, it's just basically you want to establish a bond with your children and not to come in with total preconceived notions about how they ought to behave. The idea is to listen and to establish a link of trust, so that you can really be there for them instead of alienating them. And so you have to learn about these substances and the possible substances that they're using, so that you can be an informed assist for them. You want to...
I wanted to say one thing.
Okay. Yeah.
I just wanted to remind people that, like, when you... as parents, we know that if we go ballistic about something, that is a signal to them, don't talk about that anymore. So when you hear something that you don't like, it's almost counterintuitive not to, let the lid fly off. But that's kind of what we have to be as adults, is, a listener, and really, because then they'll come back and talk to you more about it. So that's a really crucial time.
Yeah, and it's not easy to restrain yourself from when you have kids from a bowl telling them how they should behave. So This is a kind of a funny thing, but basically you want to encourage whatever creative and physical activities your youngsters really want to explore. And
this is the one in the middle is what they're doing when they have free time.
Yeah.
But, keep them busy between 3 and 6. That's the time when most teenagers are using drugs. That's what we were reading. And so we were thinking about, well, what else could they be doing? Well.
Yeah, we avoided the teen porn.
That's what they could be doing.
But the other thing is to actively engage in whatever kind of social life they have, just as a leader in terms of the PTA and things that are part of their peers, parents, and their teachers' situation. You know, just get involved with their school.
Yeah, we were always the parents in the school setting, or the teacher, the PTA situation that kind of, I don't know, everybody looked at us like they knew, you know, you guys do drugs, you know. But, you know, we had some interesting points of view, so you have to be there and speak up, you know, and be a reality check for the rest of the group in the straight back chairs.
Yeah. And so also be willing to recognize if there's a problem, you know. If the kids are struggling and they're hooked, you have to be able to. If you have this bond of trust, you may be able to be there to be a support. Safety First is a great organization, and safetyfirst.org is a. They have a lot of literature and support.
Yeah, I just wanted to. Yeah.
Marsha Rosenbaum is a terrific.
This is not the newest version, but I would definitely go online if you're a parent and download the PDF and take a look at. This is the old one. I left the new one somewhere. But I just say, yeah, really. I mean, you wanna be informed as a parent.
Okay.
Marsha Rosenbaum, by the way, works for Drug Policy Alliance. She's one of us.
Yeah.
So she goes around and talks to people about the reality-based approach.
Yeah. PTA meetings. She's an awesome lady. So this is one view of how states also can respect the parental authority, basically allowing them to make decisions about whether sharing a drink with their kids is okay. So this is instead of just an age limit on drinking and things like that. This is interesting because we don't want to discount that there are some substances like methamphetamine and stuff that if you get hooked can be completely self-destructive.
There's a difference.
Yeah. This is a...
this is what we fear.
Yeah, and it's the kind of thing that if you've already been lying to your kids about drugs, then why should they listen to you about anything, you know, and including the dangers of meth. So then in the West, there's this condemnation of psychedelic use, and nevertheless, it continues to be used and by a significant proportion of teenagers and young adults. From 18 to 25. It's interesting. I think that this is one of our biggest problems as entheogen users and as parents and things like that, is that we're lacking context for the use of the substances in a kind of sacred setting. But we can... And so there's been a kind of social disintegration that sometimes follows the use of psychedelics. Just this past summer, we had two young friends who were 18 years old that went through a kind of, almost schizophrenic break because they really, I think that they could have gotten through it if they had the proper kind of supportive setting, but they used the substances in a, social settings that weren't really conducive to a spiritual emergence, and so they wound up in the hospitals and have had continued problems. So I think this lack of a sacred context for the Western use of entheogens is a true area that we have to learn about and develop strategies to work with. In places like the Brazil and the UDV, the adolescents in that society use ayahuasca in a very positive, life-enhancing way. It's a way of also bonding with the group. We go through such alienation. In some ways, that's really important to distinguish ourselves from our parents. But the these substances can help us to overcome the sort of divisiveness and the face the inner problems directly. In the UDV, the pregnant mothers are encouraged to use the ayahuasca, and it's used even during childbirth. The young children are given a little bit as they're growing up and until they're able to use full servings. I wanted to point out that one is the UDV Church and the other is a Barquinha, that they're all ayahuasca churches from down in Brazil. One of the indigenous tribes of Peru used the ayahuasca as a part of their religious upbringing, and it's a window to enlightenment, a portal to divination, and a teacher of plant and hunting and spiritual knowledge, a way of integrating also with their society. The Bwiti initiate the young in their iboga ceremonies, and so this is another model, another way of looking at this sort of drug use as an initiation and a kind of rite of passage. And in the Native American church, the teenagers are actively encouraged to take part in the ceremonies, in the all-night peyote use. And it integrates them into the tradition. And the Huichol, I think, have a fascinating kind of use of peyote. They also use during the pregnancy and childbirth. And they start using the substances from around age 6 to 8. And it's interesting that they believe that it should be used in kind of earlier childhood before they reach this age of understanding, and that is the they say that they should have reached the age of understanding so they can verbally articulate their experience, but before the sort of sexual and other kinds of identity questions of teenagehood kind of click in. I can imagine that this keys them into their kind of tribal culture in an extraordinary way, and they gain access to the imaginal worlds, and this just becomes a permanent part of their worldview.
It's an initiation, of course, into their community. It's like becoming part of your community, saying, like, you're 6 years old, but you are part of us, you're one of us.
Yeah. Okay. So then in the book Island, Allison was mentioning that the Palanese have their own kind of ritual that involves climbing this perilous mountain and then being introduced to the moksha. And it's put in a kind of symbolic way of your life and coming toward enlightenment. So it's another initiatory rite, a way to use these substances in a way that's respectful of their sacramental quality. And Huxley, in Island, is talking about how do we educate our children, you don't give them a chance of... Okay, never give children a chance of imagining that anything exists in isolation. Make it plain from the very beginning that all living is relationship. show them relationships in the woods, in the fields, in the ponds and the streams, and in the village and the country around it. Rub it in. So, that's, I think.
We have one more.
Oh. Ha! The happy.
The happy psychedelic family. That's what that is. But, yeah. There we are. All American, overfed, psychedelic, deadheads, you know? anyway, yeah. I wanted to be personal here and talk about our personal experience as parents. We have one daughter, as some of you already are aware, as she's 19 years old. And Alex and I, after 11 years of being together, happily doing our thing as artists, I introduced the idea that we should become parents, actually. I lobbied. I took Alex up a mountain in Woodstock, New York. We took MDMA, and I introduced that. I said, if I recall, I regret to inform ourselves, after 11 years, I regret to inform ourselves that I don't want to do the life training without the parent training. I think the parent training is an important part of the life training. And we had thought we'd be child-free for a lifetime, but we, you know, like I was 34 years old, the clock was ticking, and I'm going like, wait a minute, I really think the parent training is an important part of life. I don't want to, you know, miss out on. So Alex was down. He was, you know, he was aligned.
But seemed like a really good idea.
Yeah, MDMA. I think the perfect setting. You know,
more love.
The top of a mountain, you know, hearts were open, and it was a beautiful autumn day around a little fire that we made. And Alex said, "Great, I think you're right. I really agree, except that we're really not ready because we were totally." We were performance artists that were going to parties every day, smoking, doing a lot of psychedelics, and really not living the life that, you know, we envisioned as being good parents. So Alex lobbied and initiated the idea that we should wait, that we should give ourselves this probationary period. A year was the original thought, that we would get our act together, make some money, because we thought money was so important. We learned later that it's not as that important, that children bring money. But by the way, if any of you don't have children, that's the truism. But, you know, that we should work and be abstinent. So we chose to be abstinent for a year, and it turned into a year and a half. After a year, we looked at our funds and our life, and we thought, let's give ourselves another 6 months. Have a conscious conception, which is we did have a conscious conception. I really recommend that. I won't go into that, but ask me about it or write to me about it another time. But so we waited a year and a half, absolutely with nothing. I think we maybe drank some coffee, but we didn't use alcohol or smoke pot or use psychedelics for a year and a half. And believe me, if any of you haven't gone for a year and a half without any substances, it's really a great experience. The altered state of sobriety is something that Alex and I recommend. We've had several periods in our life where we've done that, and it really is it's a wonderfully altered...
A drug fast.
A drug fast, yeah. Mm. So we went for a year and a half through to the pregnancy, and then during the pregnancy, and then through nursing, and now I nursed for 8 months. And so through all of that, we were sober, absolutely no substances at all, and it was fantastic. And just didn't want to take any chances. I was 34, 36 years old by then. You know, I just didn't want to take any chances. And we got pregnant the first time we ever, the first and only time we ever tried. Every other time we tried not to. And so we did get pregnant that one time and had one child. We only had one. Terrence recommended that we not replace ourselves. He heard the elves telling him, actually.
Yeah, he's, let's see, Terrence said, well, all this visionary stuff is really interesting, but can you tell me something really worthwhile and useful and something, you know, down to earth? And the mushroom said, have only one child, you know. It will make your lives easier, and it will be less of a load on the planet. So, Good idea.
We thought about it, but we never tried again, and decided that the triangle configuration of our family was perfect for us. And so, yeah, so what did we do about drugs and teaching Zena about drugs? Well, you know, through those early years, children just don't like to have a lot of smoke around them, and you don't really want to smoke on top of them. So we pretty much limited our use to when she wasn't around. We didn't, like, keep it from her, and we always answered her questions. This is what my mother taught me when it came to sex, and I applied it to drugs. Just whenever they ask a question, you answer it. And, you know, you don't tell them the things that they don't want to know or they're not ready to know. But if they ask you something, you tell them honestly. I would never keep anything from Zena, and so she doesn't keep all that much from me. I mean, I'm sure she keeps something, but, you know, we've been pretty open with each other through the years. And so we answered the questions, and then as time progressed, well, as we wanted to take a psychedelic, we didn't include her in that experience. I mean, for three reasons. We would basically get a babysitter, and we would go somewhere and do it elsewhere. Or we would make sure she was taken care of, maybe she was visiting a friend or going to camp or something. And then we would use psychedelics for three reasons. One, we didn't want to be weird around her. Like, what if we acted a little strange and maybe she would think, what's going on with mom and dad, you know? And number two, you know, what if something happened? You know, what if something went on fire or she got hurt or she needed us to be completely, you know, like, available and present? And we weren't. I would not want to blame it on the substance, on the Holy Sacrament. So the third reason is really personal and selfish, that I don't want to be worrying about Zena. I don't want to be thinking about a young child when I'm having my own personal experience. It's something that you do, you know, for your inner life and your partner life, if you do it with a partner. And so, you know, for that reason, for those reasons, we never tripped around Zena. And during, especially the years, like, I say, between 8 and 12, they're very rule conscious and very rule oriented, and they really understand about following the rules and not following the rules. And it is illegal what you're doing, and it scares them. So during that period, our use was infrequent, and I know friends, really close friends who were users that actually gave up the substance during that period, so they wouldn't worry their children. They had just, you know, serious discussions with them, and the children were concerned about them getting caught, so they basically gave it up for a little while. It's okay to give it up for a little while. You can always go back. It's not, you know, the teaching that you've had is always there, so it actually will help you. And so our use was infrequent during that period, and not so much around her, although we always were open with questions. Then
she would come with us, though, to the psychedelic conferences.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And she had lunch with Dr. Hoffman once.
And she was like 9.
And so it's a it's interesting, though, that you know, she didn't always put everything together.
Now, I also go out and do talks, like he does. I don't know how many of you have seen him do his talk about his art, but includes like all the art that was, you know, influenced by psychedelics, and he discusses, you know, the influence and what he saw when he was under the influence. And Zena would be sitting in the front row when she was 2, and when she was 4, and when she was 6, and she would hear these talks over and over again. And then when she was 10, I remember her saying to me one time walking down the street, she said, "I know that you and Dad do smoke marijuana, but that's all." And I went, "I just didn't say anything." I mean, because that's all she really wanted to know. That's what she had made up in her mind. It's kind of like, well, I know there's Santa Claus, you know, because I saw him. I mean, what do you say? No, there isn't. You know, you don't kill their fantasy, whatever it is. And so when she finally came around to understanding that that was part of our life, I mean, they only hear what they want to hear. So you only answer what they ask you. If she doesn't ask a question, I didn't answer it. So, you know.
At the same time, then, when those questions did come up, we had to address the idea that this is like the early Christians living in the their spiritual lives in the catacombs and things. This is not something to discuss with your friends at school. This is not, unfortunately, you know, we're part of a of an underground society, and that's a heavy burden to place on a young mind if they're not ready. But at the time that she seemed ready, we delivered that one too.
But they also really appreciate that you confide in them like that, and they do keep the secret. They do keep it to themselves. Like, we explained to her what could happen if she told her friends that we smoke pot. You know, they would not, you know, their parents might not let their children come to our house. So that was, you know, or something worse could happen. You know, they could come and send and take us away. Oh, we gotta go.
You're listening to the Psychedelic Salon, where people are changing their lives one thought at a time.
As you can tell, this group discussion was just getting off the ground when time ran out. But Allison told me that this led to an informal discussion for another couple of hours, and they even had to finally cut that off in order to get to lunch. Obviously, there is a need for much more discussion about this sensitive topic in our community, and we are certainly fortunate to have Allison and Alex leading the charge here. I suspect that they are the kind of parents many of us would have liked to have been or would like to be. In my own case, I have to admit to being a real jerk about drugs until I finally tried them myself. Until then, my poor children had to put up with me parroting that stupid "just say no" line. So I'm very grateful to Allison and Alex for putting themselves on the line and speaking in public about this very important issue. Let's face it, each generation seems to be a little bit more aware of the real world than their parents are. And once they catch us lying about something like cannabis, they may never trust us again. As a side note, by the way, we just now heard Alex mention Terrence McKenna's proposal that each of us only reproduce once. And if you want to hear his proposal in greater detail, I believe it's part of the McKenna Talk that I podcast in program number 122. And how do you feel about Alex's comparison of psychedelic families to early Christians living in the catacombs? While I prefer to think of us as a Robin Hood-like band of merry outlaws, there is a ring of truth to the catacomb analogy. The underlying truth, of course, can be found in Ray and Anderson's great book, The Cultural Creatives, where there are references to the psychedelic community as being among the core of the core cultural creatives. And now that we number in the many, many millions worldwide, our influence in all walks of life is finally beginning to be felt more clearly. Which brings me to the next short talk I want to play for you. As I mentioned earlier, it's from a trilogue, only the second public one, by the way, that Ralph Abraham, Terrence McKenna, and Rupert Sheldrake held at Esalen sometime in 1992. And if I'm not mistaken, this was their first public trilogue since the publication of their first joint book, Trilogues at the Edge of the West. Their first session in this series of trilogues was actually held at night and consisted primarily of the workshop participants telling a little about themselves, along with a discussion of crop circles. And the reason I'm not taking your time with that today is that their crop circle discussion was significantly revised in later discussions, some of which I've already podcast. So right now I'm going to pick up with the first morning session. We begin with Ralph Abraham, and after he goes over a few housekeeping details, he tells what for me is the confirmation of something I've known for a long time. And that story is the story of how the personal computer revolution, the digital revolution, if you will, has been founded in a large part and sustained by members of the psychedelic community. Just like psychedelics brought you rock and roll, they have also brought you the digital age, complete with internet-downloaded podcasts. This is certainly a fascinating story, an important story, a historical story. And now we're going to get to hear it told by one of its most influential protagonists, Ralph Abraham.
Last night we spoke of our process, but we didn't do it. So, you know that this is only the second time that we have been trialoguing in public, but for many years we are trialoguing in private. And our plan here is to try to maintain our private process in public. So whereas we are interested in your feedback eventually, what we would like to begin with is to have the space to proceed as we do in private to the degree that we can. And at the same time, of course, we can't help but be conscious of the fact that you're here and we've tuned. So I would ask you, if you think of questions while we're talking, to note them down, because we are interested to hear them eventually and to respond if we can, as time permits, later. But for an hour or so, we'd like the space to perform like television to a passive audience, in spite of the fact that we are always complaining about this passive addiction. And that's one of our so-called rules. We have some other ones that we've... some other rules that we have evolved, or rules or methods of inducing an altered state, a joint state, the trialogue mode. And this is consists, the main step is kind of an induction. And so usually we have an induction process in which one person makes the call to the trialogue mode. And in spite of what Terence said, I'm not going to do a dog and pony show, but I'm going to take my turn this morning at the induction, which usually takes 15 or 20 minutes. But having given these rules, I'm now going to break them. And because you are here, we felt the need for a slightly longer induction. And what I'm going to do is to try to set the stage not only for this morning's trialogue, but for the whole day. So I'm going to, there's three steps then. I'm going to tell a personal story. Then I'm going to show a video that lasts 10 minutes. And then I'm going to do the induction for this morning's trialogue, which will necessarily have to be really compressed. So we have developed some methods for the rapid induction of the trialogue state. And I'm going to experiment with another shortcut to the induction process this morning, which, of course, if I risk this, might fail. So the first story took place a year ago, and Terence and Rupert were involved in no part of this story. I was sitting in my office with my secretary, Nina, about a year and a half ago. There was a knock on the door. She said, "Well, this is a friend of a friend of mine who wants to interview you." But I was very busy with the telephone and the correspondence and stuff, so he came and sat, and I answered his questions without thinking. Later on, a month or so passed, a photographer arrived, and I began to realize that I'd done something significant. I'd given an interview for GQ magazine. I called my children, who know about such things, and asked them what was GQ magazine, and they knew what it was and follow and read it to some extent. They live in Hollywood. I was in Italy when the magazine finally arrived on the stands. And of course I had notified my children, my mother, and everybody. I was very proud that, in spite of my style of dress, that I had been the first one in our circle to actually be photographed for GQ. But I was shocked in Firenze to open the first page of the magazine and to see my picture occupying a large part of the first page, the table of contents page, where the heading says, Abraham sells drugs to mathematicians. And there were some other insulting things in the interview that, as far as I could remember, was largely fiction that occurred later on in the magazine. So I didn't mention it to anybody. I came back to California, and I was very pleased that nobody mentioned it. Nobody had noticed. There were one or two phone calls, and I realized that nobody, after all, does read GQ. And if they do look at the pictures, they somehow overlooked mine. So I squeaked by, and I was safe after all this dangerous pass, being outed by GQ. Suddenly, my peace was disturbed once again by 100 phone calls in a single day, asking what did I think of the article about me in the San Francisco Examiner or the Chronicle or the San Jose Mercury and so on. After all, the embers in the fire left by GQ had flamed up again in the pen of a journalist, a woman who writes a computer column for the San Francisco Examiner, had received in her mailbox a copy of this article in GQ, in which Timothy Leary is quoted as saying, the Japanese go to Burma for teak and they go to California for novelty and creativity. And everybody knows that California has this resource thanks to psychedelics. And there again, it quoted me as the supplier of a scientific renaissance in the 1960s. And this columnist didn't believe what was asserted by Timothy Leary and others in the GQ article, that the computer revolution and the computer graphic innovations of California had been built upon a psychedelic foundation. So she set out to prove that this story was false. She was about to go to SIGGRAPH, the largest gathering of computer graphic professionals in the world. Annually, somewhere in the United States, 30,000 or so people gather, all of whom are vitally involved in the computer revolution. She thought she would set this heresy to rest by conducting a sample survey at SIGGRAPH a year ago in Las Vegas. She began her interviews at the airport the minute she stepped off the plane, and by the time she got back to her desk in San Francisco, had talked to 180 important professionals of the computer graphic field, all of whom answered yes to her question, do you take psychedelics and is this important in your work? So her column in the syndicated in all these newspapers finally said that, and again, unfortunately, or kindly, remembered me. Shortly after this second accident in my story, I was in Hollyhock, the Esalen of the far north, with Rupert and some others of you here. And I had a kind of psychotic break in the night. I couldn't sleep, and I was consumed with a paranoid fantasy about this outage and what it would mean in my future career and the police at my door and so on. And I knew that my fears had kind of blown up unnecessarily, but I needed someone to talk to. The person I knew best there was Rupert, and he was very busy in council with various friends, but eventually I took Rupert aside and I confided to him this secret and all my fears. And his response within a day or two was to repeat the story to everybody in Canada. Well, assuring me that it's good to be outed and it would be good to come out, and to come out maybe in a best-selling book, which Brockman, our agent, could sell and hawk for a huge royalty advance and so on. I tried thinking positively about this episode, but when I came home, I still felt nervous about it, and I said no to many interviews from ABC News and the United Nations and other people who called to check out this significant story. I did not rise to the occasion, and so I've decided today by popular request, to tell the truth. And this is perhaps relevant to our theme for today, different aspects of vision, and our theme this morning of psychedelics and mathematical vision. So it all began in 1967 when I was a professor of mathematics at Princeton, and one of my students turned me on to LSD. That led to my moving to California a year later and my meeting at UC Santa Cruz, a chemistry graduate student who is doing his PhD thesis on the synthesis of DMT. He and I smoked up a large bottle of DMT in 1969. And that resulted in a kind of secret resolve which swerved my career to a search for the connections between mathematics and the experience of the logos, or what Terence calls the transcendent other. This hyperdimensional space full of meaning and wisdom and beauty which feels more real than ordinary reality, and to which we have returned many times over the years for instruction and pleasure. And in the course of the next 20 years, there were various steps I took to explore this connection between mathematics and the logos. For example, I apprenticed myself to neurophysiologists and tried to construct brain models made out of the basic objects of chaos theory. This was about the time that chaos theory was discovered by the scientific community, and the chaos revolution began in 1973. I built a vibrating fluid machine to visualize vibrations in transparent media, because I felt on the basis of direct experience that the Hindu metaphor of vibrations was an important one, a valuable one, and therefore that we could learn more about consciousness, communication, resonance, and the emergence of form and pattern in the physical, biological, social, and intellectual worlds through actually watching vibrations in transparent media, ordinarily invisible, and making them visible. I was inspired by Hans Jaeny, an amateur scientist in Switzerland, a follower of Rudolf Steiner, who had built an ingenious gadget for rendering these transparent fluids visible. About this time, we discovered in Santa Cruz computer graphics, because the first affordable computer graphic terminals had appeared on the market. I started a project of teaching mathematics with computer graphics, and eventually tried to simulate the mathematical models for neurophysiology and for vibrating fluids in computer programs with computer graphic displays. In this way evolved a new class of mathematical models called CDs, cellular dynamata. They are really especially appropriate mathematical object for modeling or trying to understand the brain, the mind, the visionary experience, and so on, as far, as close anyway as mathematics could come to simulation of this experience. At the same time, other mathematicians, some of whom may have been recipients of my gifts in the 1960s, began their own experiments with computer graphics in different places and began to make films, which I used to show in annual film clairvoyance of this evening later on in many years later, when I would be sitting in this theater watching a computer graphic film made by Tom Benchoff. You remember that? Mm-hmm. Eventually, we were able to construct machines in Santa Cruz which could simulate these kind of mathematical models that I call CDs at a reasonable speed, first slowly and then faster and faster. And in 1989, I had a fantastic experience at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, where I was given access to, at that time, the fastest supercomputer, the MPP, the Massively Parallel Processor. And my CD model for the visual cortex had been programmed into this machine by the only person able to program it, and I was invited to come and view the result. And looking at the color screen of this supercomputer was like looking through the window at the future and seeing an excellent memory of a DMT vision, not only proceeding apace on the screen, but also going about 100 times faster than a human experience, and also under the control of knobs which I could turn at the terminal. And and so we immediately recorded this video, which I'd like to show you now. It lasts for 10 minutes. It was recorded in 1989 on the day of my first look through this window. So if you could turn this on. I don't think you have to move very far. You could use this space, and it's not, it doesn't require a perfect view of the screen. And then we'll resume my story.
I guess that's
the... Maybe we could lift up the Venetian blinds and turn up the lights now. Yes, we probably can. In fact, you can help yourself to the door. So returning to my story now, and I'll quickly bring it to a close. There is, first of all, a 20-year evolution from my DMT year, 1969, to my MPP year, 1989. And following this 20-year evolution and that the recording of that video, we had two things that I'll mention. One is the story with GQ and SIGGRAPH and the Examiner that I've told you, which essentially poses the question, then, has a psychedelic had an influence in the evolution of science, mathematics, the computer revolution, computer graphics, and so on. And the other event, in 1990, we got to see, after, I think, the publication of a paper on this in the International Journal of Bifurcation and Chaos, we saw an interesting article in the monthly notices of the American Mathematical Society, the largest union of research mathematicians in the world, which amazingly redefined mathematics, dropping number and geometrical spaces as relics of history, and adopting a new definition of mathematics as the study of space-time pattern. So this is not written by me. This is just in the pages of Science and the monthly notices of the American Mathematical Society. So we have to admit that mathematics has been reborn, and this rebirth is some kind of outcome of, apparently, of the computer revolution and the psychedelic revolution, which took place concurrently, concomitantly, cooperatively in the 1960s. And I might mention a current event on this horizon, redefining this material as an art medium. I'm going to be able to give a concert of this material played in real time with a genuine supercomputer in October in the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, the largest Gothic cathedral in the world. Well then, let's come to our subject. And I don't know if you gentlemen need to move up a little bit so that we can trilogue. Now I have to do, since I took so much time on a personal odyssey, I have to do to induce trilogue in 1 minute. And so this shortcut, what I want to do is just pose one or two questions and read one or two excerpts from some favorite books here. So we have to accept now, I think, mathematics either in the new definition or the old one. In the Renaissance cosmology of John Dee, mathematics is seen as the joint therapist of Father Sky and Mother Earth, or a kind of an intellectual spiritual elastic medium connecting up the heavenly realms and Gaia herself. That puts mathematics then in on the same level as the Logos, the Holy Spirit. So let's just consider that for the sake of discussion. And having seen it as a language of space-time pattern, let me ask you this, Terence and Roop. To what extent could the psychedelic vision of the Logos be externalized? Could it be externalized by any means, either by verbal descriptions, by computer simulations, by drawings of really inspired visionary artists? Or on the other hand, in what ways could possibly mathematical vision serve the spirit and extend the mind? Is there a role, in other words, for this kind of thing in our main concerns? And to give you a fast forward into the answer, let me just read a couple of things here from Fruit of the Gods.
Oh, good choice.
And Terence's confessional chapter, chapter 15, a section called Art in the Revolution. He says, "The archaic revival is a clarion call to recover our birthright. However uncomfortable that may make us, it is a call to realize that life lived in the absence of the psychedelic experience upon which primordial shamanism is based is life trivialized, life denied, life enslaved to the ego and its fear of disillusion in the mysterious matrix of feeling that is all around us. It is in the archaic revival that our transcendence of the historical dilemma actually lies. There is something more. It is now clear that new developments in many areas, including mind-machine interfacing, pharmacology of the synthetic variety, and data storage, imaging, and retrieval techniques. It is now clear that new developments in these areas are coalescing into the potential for a truly demonic or an angelic self-imaging of our culture." Do you remember that at all? I don't know if you've tapped into chapter 15, Roop. Here's another one then, in the Rebirth of Nature, the final paragraph of the entire book entitled A New Renaissance. Rupert says, "As soon as we allow ourselves to think of the world as alive, we recognize that a part of us knew this all along. It is like emerging from winter into spring. We can begin to reconnect our mental life with our own direct intuitive experiences of nature. We can participate in the spirits of sacred places and times. We can see that we have much to learn from traditional societies who have never lost their sense of connection with the living world around them. We can acknowledge the animistic traditions of our ancestors, and we can begin to develop a richer understanding of human nature, shaped by tradition and collective memory, linked to the earth and the heavens, related to all forms of life, and consciously open to the creative power expressed in all evolution. We are reborn into a living world." I call down then the trialogue mode. Psychedelics and mathematical vision.
I'm sorry to have to cut this off right here, but in order to keep this podcast from running excessively long, I'm going to save the next part of this trialogue for our next podcast. I will tell you, however, that the first person to respond to Ralph's questions was Terence. Now, I know that there are a few Slawners out there who are around my age and can remember the old Saturday matinee cliffhanger movies. You know, the last show always ended with the hero swinging on a vine with a girl in his arms, dozens of hungry crocodiles below, and then the vine snaps and cut. You had to come back the following week to learn that, fortunately, there was a small ledge just 2 feet below where the vine snapped. Saved again. But I don't really mean for this to be one of those cliffhangers. It's just that if I played the rest of this trilogue, we'd be here for another hour or so, and that really is too long for one of these podcasts. But I do promise to get the rest of this trilogue out in the next podcast as soon as I can. You know, just now when Ralph was talking about visually representing a psychedelic experience, I was reminded of a short video that one of our fellow saloners, Dylan, produced. There's a link to it on the psychedelicsalon.org blog under the post, I think it's titled, He Climbed In. And what I like about this video is that the images are very subdued, which allows you to focus on what I think is really excellent dialogue. I found the piece very compelling, and at times it reminded me of several different kinds of trips I've had. So, well done, Dylan. I really enjoy your work. And one last thing I want to mention is a video that's up on Google Video right now, and it's titled American Drug War, The Last White Hope. And be sure that you add The Last White Hope in your search, because there are other videos with the first part of that title. Of course, the fact that some of the faces in this documentary are those of people who have been our guests here in the salon makes me like it even more, probably. So if you have time, you might want to check it out. I first learned that it was available online from a posting by Sancho23 on our forum at thegrowreport.com. And that post was followed by a lot of additional commentary by several people, like Victoria Pandora and A Dime Short and others. In fact, it was A Dime Short's comment about Gary Fisher being in the film that prompted me to watch the entire two-hour video in order to be sure not to miss him. Because I remember him telling me about the day the film crew shot the interview. Hopefully we'll get him to tell that story someday. But as it turns out, they cut out most of what he had to say in his interview, which is only to be expected. That's what documentary filmmakers do. However, there is a serious problem with the way they introduced Gary. As you longtime saloners know, Gary worked with Timothy Leary in Mexico, the Caribbean, and at Millbrook. But this documentary takes this little fact a little too far and claims that, and I quote, known to be the man who introduced Dr. Timothy Leary to LSD. Well, that is simply wrong. It isn't the truth, not even close to the truth, in fact. And I hope to get Gary to tell the story of his original contact with Dr. Leary sometime here for a podcast. But until then, I can assure you that Tim Leary and Richard Alpert had experimented with LSD long before asking Gary to join them. My guess is that Gary told the filmmakers that it was his protocol for using LSD in a professional setting is what he introduced to Leary and Alpert, now known as Ram Dass, of course. So you can do our community a favor whenever discussion of this film comes up by clearing up that one little factual mistake. And one final thing I'd like to mention today is about our Planque Norte mailing list and our Planque Norte tribe at tribe.net. I'm sorry to say that I just don't have the time to put into that project right now, and so the list is inactive, and it's doubtful that there will be any Planque Norte plylogs at Burning Man this year, mainly because I'm not going to be able to make it myself. But I will keep you posted as the burn gets closer and let you know some of the theme camps who have fellow saloners among them. And if all goes well, you should be able to make some lifelong friends there this year. So stay tuned. Or stay subscribed, I guess I should say. You do know, I hope, that subscriptions of this podcast through iTunes and other aggregators is free. Of course you know that. What am I thinking? Anyway, I do plan on bringing you some more information about this year's festival in the months ahead. Well, I guess that's about it for today. And as always, I want to close by saying that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are available for your use under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at psychedelicsalon.org. And that's also where you'll find the program notes for these podcasts. And for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.